listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Laura Sanders, Executive Director of the Rita Dean and Abbey Art Museum. January is International Creativity Month, and the museum celebrates the creative work of Rita Dean and Abbey, who taught art at UNLV for more than 20 years. Laura, thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure, Heather.
So for those who don't know the museum, what is the Rita Dean and Abbey Art Museum all about?
Well, the Rita Dean and Abbey Art Museum is a single artist museum, and it is centered around specific creations of her individual art, her archives, and biographical information. The unique focus allows us to explore the relationship with the artist profoundly. I'd say the museum serves as a gateway to understanding the dynamic nature of the creative process for examining history through the lens of one individual's life's work. The Rita Dean and Abbey Art Museum's mission is to preserve, present, and advance the artistic legacy of Rita Dean and Abbey through exhibitions, programs, and events. Our vision is to become a Las Vegas destination museum that is locally relevant and internationally significant. We want to invite, inspire, and provide experiences for all kinds of visitors. And we are really trying to make meaningful connections with audience that celebrates the art and the life of an artist. So when you think about other single artist museum, who comes to mind? Another person that was inspired by the Desert Southwest, Georgia O'Keeffe. And Nevada should be extremely proud that we have this caliber of a museum in Nevada, in the valley, actually.
Yeah, where is it located?
We are located in the northwest side of town off the 215 on Ann Road. So we're in the shadow of the Spring Mountains. So it's a lovely drive out here, and it's really easy to get off the 95 or the 215. And we're on 10 and a half acres with a museum that is 10,500 square feet. And when you visit, you feel like you're going to the MoMA or the Met. It's that high caliber of a museum. And you don't have to pay to park.
Nice. Okay, with a 10,500 square foot museum, that's a lot of art. What kind of art did Rita create?
Well, Rita was a multidisciplined artist. She worked in about every different types of media that you can think of. So when you come here, you think it's the work of 8 to 10 artists, because you're going to see 6 10-ton Corten steel sculptures outside that you can take and walk through. You're going to see paintings, porcelain enamel fired on steel, watercolors, bronze sculptures, all the way down to stained glass windows. So if you visited the Summerlin Library, that big, beautiful sculpture in the front of it called Spirit Tower, that's Rita Abbey.
Okay, nice. Now, besides being an artist, as I mentioned, she taught at UNLV for more than 20 years. What did her students at UNLV say about her?
It's a great question, because they still come in today and they have these fantastic stories of Rita. Rita was so unique. She developed interdisciplinary classes at UNLV where she'd take her students into the physics department or into the geology department. In the 1970s, to share her inspiration, because she was inspired by nature and the forces of nature, she took her class on a 6-day raft trip down the Colorado River through Cataract Canyon. And that's pretty wild. That's a wild river ride. So while she was on the river, she journaled and sketched. And this trip and those sketches were the catalyst of a book she wrote called River Trip. They were drawings, watercolors, and narrative poems. that provide a visual and literary diary of her experiences on the river. One of the students that was on that river trip is now working in animation for Disney. So another one of her students did all the clothing design for Dune. So she has made an impact on a lot of art students' life.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Now, you knew Rita for a long time as well. What do you remember most about her?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to meet Rita in 1989, 1990, when I became her archivist, and I started the creation of a searchable database for her and just continued to work for her until 2006. Rita had a deep stillness about her. When you were with her, you were really with her. She was funny. She had the best smile, but she worked endlessly, tirelessly on her art. She was always working on something. Yeah, and to get the creative juices flowing, she subconsciously drew inspiration from nature to enhance her creative process. So being influenced by nature and the forces of nature, and when you come and see her art, you can really see this. She was influenced by geological formations, changing atmospheric conditions such as rain or storms. And she would capture all of this in her abstract compositions. So her focus on detail, contrast, and unity reflects her impressions of the environment and its inner artwork. You know, and when I say stuff like that, I know it sounds so complex. But what I really want to say, that is, you don't need to know a lot about art to visit the museum. You don't need to know about line, form, you know, space, texture. What you really need to do when you come to an art museum is to experience how that piece of art makes you feel. When you come to our museum, the Abbey Art Museum, there's a painting called Sharp Angle of the Wind. And I love to see how that makes people feel, or how it feels to be water moving through a canyon. So as you spend more time with the art that makes you have these emotions, that's when you learn, you start to learn about lines and patterns, light, form, texture. And that's what's inspiring to me about abstract art.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, Las Vegas is known for entertainment, but not necessarily art. What's the importance of having an art scene in Las Vegas?
Well, if you get online and you're looking for something to do, and you look at the list of museums or specialty museums or nature or wildlife areas in Las Vegas, you'll be so surprised. There'll be something to do once a month for years. I mean, there's the Springs Preserve, the Las Vegas Natural History. Now, all these are my sister museums. The Mob Museum is quite different from what you're going to see here, but still a lot of fun. The Neon Museum, Burlesque, Real Bodies, and the new Punk Rock Museum. I don't know. I think you should have the Children's Discovery Museum, Melissa Kaiser, the director there, or the Atomic Museum, Rob McCoy, come and visit the show. Also, in a year, maybe 2 years, we'll have our own Las Vegas Art Museum with Heather Harmon as the executive director. There's also another new museum, the Nevada State Railroad Museum, and they even have a Wells Fargo Stagecoach. I would love to go see that. But of course, the long-awaited Las Vegas Museum of Art, which has partnered with the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, LACMA, that is going to be fantastic. So Nevada's going to have an art museum downtown and a single artist museum out in the Northwest. And so you'll always have something cultural to do with your family and friends.
Yeah, that's great. What do you think the future of art museums will look like, not just in Vegas, but around the world?
That's a really interesting question. Last year, we partnered with UNLV's College of Liberal Arts intern program, and museum studies have become really popular. They encompass more than just cataloging artifacts or arranging displays. They involve becoming storytellers and guardians of our shared heritage, the architects of experiences that connect the past with the future. I think museum studies teaches you to create spaces where wonder thrives and communities can come together. Museum studies is a really broad academic field, and there are people from so many different walks of life. And I just encourage, young people to look into that if they're into art.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting. I was an art major myself back in the day, and I don't remember that being a thing, but I have to say, I really would have liked to have a teacher like Rita. She sounds fantastic.
She was a very unique human being. And when you come to the museum and you see this great body of work, and then you realize it's just the tip of the iceberg, because in the archives, we have thousands of pieces that aren't on display yet. We've been working with Art Bridges, and we've come up with a catalog of about 60 works that will be on loan to other museums, gifted to other museums, and perhaps we'll be able to sell a few pieces of her original works soon.
That's awesome. So how can people find out more about the Rita Dean and Abby Art Museum, or actually visit the museum and its galleries and experience them in person?
Well, you can just visit ritadeanandabbymuseum.org. We're open Thursday through Sunday, 10 to 5. Tickets are available by appointment only, but you can get them online. If you're Las Vegas local, just put in local and you'll get a discount on the ticket. They're typically $20, but for locals, it's $15. And yeah, the museum opened in 2022, 1 year after Rita's death, and it presents a small sampling of the wondrous array of art created by one woman, Rita Dean and Abby.
That's awesome. So once again, that website is ritadeanandabbymuseum.org. It's spelled ritadeanandabbymuseum.org. And you can find out more about the museum. You can find out more about Rita Dean and Abby and what she meant to the Las Vegas community. The museum is open from Thursday to Sunday, 10 to 5. Tickets are by appointment and you can reserve them online. Locals get a discount. So once again, the website is ritadeanandabbymuseum.org. And we've been speaking today with Laura Sanders. She's the executive director of the Rita Dean and Abby Art Museum. And Laura, I really appreciate you being here and letting us know more about Rita and her work and how she influenced the art and culture in the Valley and so many students that she taught at UNLV for more than 20 years. Sounds like an amazing museum that you have up there in the northwest corner of the Valley, and I definitely want to come visit it as well, and I hope that a lot of other people do. Of course, January being International Creativity Month, it's the perfect time to find out how creative Rita was and how she contributed to creativity. And once again, that website, ritadeanandabbymuseum.org. Laura, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to having you visit.
The Library of Congress invites you to visit the revamped Veterans History Project website, where firsthand accounts shared by U.S. military veterans are accessible to the public. Performing a search of the collection is easy. First, go to loc.gov/vets. Click Explore the Collections. Scroll down to Search the VHP Collections and click. Make sure you're searching this collection, and with simple keywords, you can find what you're looking for. Visit loc.gov/vets today.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Dr. Kyle Canold, superintendent of the Delta Academy. National School Choice Week takes place from January 26th to February 1st, and the Delta Academy is all about offering choices for students and their parents. Dr. Knoll, thank you so much for being here today.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.
So first of all, what is the Delta Academy?
The Delta Academy is a public charter school in North Las Vegas. We've been educating the youth of Southern Nevada since 2007, so in our 18th year, and we educate students in grades 6 through 12.
Okay, and you said North Las Vegas. Where exactly is it located?
We are located on the corner of Brooks and Revere, but in kind of broader areas, Cheyenne and MLK.
What would you say is unique about the school?
Delta Academy offers a very flexible learning program. We have a traditional model where students attend 5 days a week. We have an online instructional model where students can complete the majority of their work online. And then we have a hybrid model where students can come in if they maybe aren't very good at, let's say, math. They can come in every day to get live instruction from the classroom teacher in math and then do the rest of their work online. And we also have a dual credit program with College of Southern Nevada as our strategic partner for that. So students can earn college credit and high school credit at the same time for free. So we pay for the tuition fees, books, everything for the College of Southern Nevada.
That's awesome. What kind of success has Delta Academy seen from offering those four education models for flexible learning?
When we started in 2007, one of the first things I noticed was that a lot of our students had obligations outside of school. They either had to maybe take care of their parents, take care of their siblings, had to work, or take care of their own children. So they were missing a lot of school because of those obligations. So we added that the online component in 2008 just to offer that flexibility so students can do their work at 2 a.m. They can do it on Saturday and Sunday. They don't have to come in 5 days a week, which really is amazing. Our online program, especially after COVID, has increased fourfold since 2020. And luckily enough, our graduation rate has also increased from about 60% to 81%. So the students are finding a lot of success doing the online program. We provide a ton of support through tutoring. They can come on campus once a week and meet with their teachers and socialize with their friends. And we have a group of educators that basically reach out to the student every day just to make sure that they don't have any questions or if there's any issues, any technology or any questions in content areas that we can address.
Interesting. Okay. So during COVID, when all the other schools went online, you had already been doing it for 12 years. What was that like?
Well, COVID was unfortunate, obviously, but we were able to have all the students that were in the traditional program switch 100% online in a day. And so we missed one day of instruction. And then after that, the students were taking their courses just like they were in the traditional school. Their teachers were meeting with them every day. So we had the ability to really meet the needs of all of our students within 24 hours. And we provided the technology support and Chromebooks and hotspots for internet connection for those students that didn't have a good internet connection. So it was really a successful transition for Delta in that unfortunate event.
Yeah. So the Delta Academy obviously offers a lot of choices and options. Why is school choice important for families and communities?
Well, school choice offers the families the ability to select their schools that kind of best align with their kids' unique learning needs and interests. Also, they're not confined to their home school, their zone school, just because of the zip code in which they live. And they can search for schools that have maybe programs that are more interesting to the student than just the general programs. There are schools out there for performing arts, for technology, for teaching, for nursing, for pre-med. So there's a lot of options out there for school choice. And so it really helps the parent be the one that's the decision maker in their child's education, as opposed to just where they live in a community.
Yeah. What feedback have you received from students and parents about how that school choice has impacted them?
It's been very impactful that most of our students didn't find success in their zone school. So that's why they're looking for options. And some of them wanted the traditional program and some of them just wanted online because of various reasons. Again, the busyness of their schedule or social phobia or issues, mental health, perhaps learning that they just need some extra time with that. And so just having that ability to pick a school that fits students' strengths, minimizes areas of weakness, then that just really sets the student up and the family up for success and hopefully increasing then the generational wealth of the family that the child will finish high school, be motivated to go to college or go to a trade school and get a good job after high school. And so that's why we're really in this business, is to ensure that students find success both socially, academically, and be ready to be a productive part of our society and then raise the next generation to push a little further.
Yeah, that's great. Now, beyond the Delta Academy, how has school choice increased in general in Las Vegas throughout the years?
In about the last 6 years, charter school campuses have increased by 16%, but the number of students enrolled in charter schools within that same time frame has increased by 54%, with the majority of them in Clark County. And that's 70,000 students are enrolled in charter schools statewide, which is about 15% of the total public students. And then if you add private schools, then that percentage goes up to 20%. So it's a very large portion of public education school choice. And again, provides great opportunity for students and parents to find where they can flourish.
So then what's the importance of charter schools as an option for parents and students overall?
Outside of school choice, probably the biggest one is that it's tuition free. And so if you are looking for school choice, there are magnet programs within some CCSD schools that have specific focuses. And then charter schools, and then after that is tuition-based private schools. So if a parent is looking for something that is tuition-free, then the charter school movement is right where that parent should be.
And what is the difference between a charter school and a magnet school?
Magnet school is a part of CCSD, so they're housed inside like Rancho High School has a magnet program. Many of the schools within the inner city have magnet programs, and the difference is that that's still within the CCSD umbrella and still considered a CCSD school. Charter schools are outside of that, so we function independently from Clark County School District. And so we have a little more autonomy to do things the way we feel are good for the students, good for the parents, good for the community. Kind of cuts a lot of the red tape and bureaucracy of a large school district, which is CCSD. So we can make changes quicker, pivot quicker, address needs more efficiently than in a larger district. But the drawback is we don't have the resources and don't have some of the other programs that CCSD offers. So there is a give and take. So you just have to figure out what's important to you personally. Do you want a comprehensive experience in high school with football, baseball, basketball, all the sports, all the dances, all the programs, all the clubs? Or do you want to focus on one or two or three things specifically that maybe a charter school can offer that CCSD does not?
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. What do you see as the future of school choice?
Well, what I would love to see for the future of school choice is the education savings account in the state of Nevada being fully funded and promoted. Most of the funds to pay for public education come from taxes. And so students that attend private schools, their parents still pay taxes and then they pay tuition. So what I would love to see is that the funds that would normally go to that child if they went to a public school would then be transferred to whatever school they'd like. So if they want to go to a private school, those funds that the public school would have received would transfer to the private school. And that would really provide a lot of opportunity, especially for some lower middle income families that can't afford a full tuition. And that the support from this education savings account would provide that tuition or majority of the tuition for the private school. And then they would only have to make up the difference, which in some private schools is considerate. But for the most part, I think it would cover the majority of the private school tuition.
Yeah. Okay. That would be awesome. So where can listeners go for more information about Delta Academy and the programs that you offer there?
Yeah, they can go to our website, deltaacademylv.com. And we do have a Rock Academy of Performing Arts. So we don't have traditional band. We have a group that just studies rock music, learns electric guitar, drums, keyboard, singing. We have a commercial drone pilot program, so students can go through this program and earn their FAA flight certification when they're finished with the program. So we have a lot of great things going on at Delta. So just go to the website or call 702-396-2252 and get information from there.
Okay, so once again, that website is deltaacademylv.com. Of course, LV for Las Vegas, deltaacademylv.com. The physical campus is located near MLK and Cheyenne, but as you've heard, they have a variety of different learning options, in-person schooling, online, hybrid, and dual credit for college. They also have the Rock Academy of Performing Arts if your student is into music. They've got a commercial drone pilot program if your child is interested in that. So deltaacademylv.com is the place to go. And again, National School Choice Week takes place from January 26th to February 1st. So this is a perfect time to consider different options for school choices that exist in the Las Vegas Valley, including Delta Academy. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Kyle Canald. He's the superintendent of the Delta Academy. And Dr. Canald, I really appreciate you being here and letting us know more about the Delta Academy. It sounds like a fantastic school with a lot of different options that could be very beneficial for students who are looking for those types of programs. And of course, during National School Choice Week, it's the perfect time to look at it. And school choice is definitely a very good thing to take into consideration. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate you and our governor that he's a very big supporter of school choice. So give a shout out to him as well. So thank you so much for your time.
Chronic absenteeism is on the rise.
Sophia A. absent.
Julio M. absent.
These absences are often due to the absence of crucial needs like food, transportation, and healthcare.
Olivia H. absent.
Preston L. absent.
But site coordinators from communities and schools connect kids to the resources they need so they show up prepared and ready to learn.
Jacob O.
present.
Visit communitiesandschools.org. Being present matters.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Dr. Ellen Maese, Research Director of Gallup, and Brad Rourke, Chief External Affairs Officer of the Kettering Foundation. Gallup and the Kettering Foundation have partnered to launch the Democracy for All project with a new national survey to evaluate how Americans perceive and experience democracy. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Great to be here.
So first of all, Brad, what is the Kettering Foundation?
Kettering Foundation is a nonprofit, nonpartisan foundation that does research and is focused on advancing inclusive democracy. We're based in Dayton, Ohio, and have offices in Washington, D.C.
Nice. Okay. And Dr. Maese, I know most people have heard of Gallup, but what exactly is Gallup?
Gallup is a research organization. We focus on bringing insights to the public and the world, representing the will and the voice of the people.
Okay. And what is the Democracy for All project all about?
Well, democracy and Americans' trust and satisfaction with it is at a critically low point, and it's been going that way for decades. This decline has been happening for decades. So we really feel like there's no better time to be asking questions like the ones that we're going to be asking about now, which is gets at everyday Americans' understanding of how their daily lives impact their satisfaction with our democracy. So people disagree about why this might be happening. And so what we really want to get at is Americans' sense of their struggles, opportunity, and feeling about their community that they live in.
Okay. And, you know, we've just had a new inauguration. Why is the Democracy for All Project significant at this specific point in time?
Well, democracy has been evolving and growing for really for centuries. And so this is an issue that goes beyond any individual, you know, administration or candidate or party. It really focuses on how is it that Americans feel about our democracy, and traditional ways of getting at that have always asked questions like, you know, how do you feel about the Supreme Court, or, you know, what's your satisfaction with the institution of Congress? And what we're really understanding is that now is the time to be asking a different set of questions than we've been asking in the past. Questions like, does my voice matter? Am I being treated fairly? If I have a problem, will the community step forward and help me? Are my streets being plowed if it's snowing, or if there's a fire, will people step forward to help me? So we're really trying to get at everyday understandings of how it is that we perceive our democracy.
And what's the difference between the traditional definition of democracy and what you believe to be the American public's current perception of democracy?
The traditional understanding of how people feel about democracy asks questions like how is it that you feel about certain institutions, or, you know, the sort of a textbook definition of democracy. But what really is important here is how everyday Americans feel about their day-to-day life and how that is reflected in the democracy around them. So different people have different understandings and ascribe different meanings to democracy. And so that's really what we're trying to get at here.
Okay. Dr. Mayase, what types of insights do you hope this research will uncover to help strengthen democracy?
Look, there's obviously a lot of work to be done in this country right now. And in order to make that work really count, we really just need a better understanding of what is exactly causing Americans to have such a sense of disconnection and dissatisfaction with their democracy. We need to dig deeper into their everyday experiences, into their hopes and dreams, their values. We need to understand their fears and frustrations. All of that really figures into how they think and feel about our democracy. We also know that there's a lot of Americans who have different opinions about what exactly in democracy is not working right now. We need to better understand where those differences lie, and we need to understand better who is feeling left out. There are Americans out there that feel that they are not valued, they are not respected or taken seriously in this country. We need to understand who those people are and what is causing them to feel that way. There are Americans feeling just disengaged with a system they don't think that they're a part of. So how do we bring them back into the fold? We really want to focus on uncovering where there are shared experiences among the American public as well. We need to find points of unity about what can be done to strengthen our democracy, to rebuild a sense of trust and confidence and belonging in American democracy right now.
And what are the key elements of this survey? Is it a series of questions that people will answer, or are there different parts involved?
Yeah, look, any survey involves the public answering questions, providing their perceptions, their insights, their feedback, and their experiences. But what really sets this research apart is that it's an opportunity for us to ask some deeper questions, questions about how Americans really feel on their day-to-day lives and how that feeds into their feelings about democracy. It's also an opportunity for us as researchers to take some extra steps to make sure that every voice in America is being included in our research. There's a really big question for a lot of us out there about whose voices are being heard in the conversations about democracy right now. So this is our opportunity to make sure that we're reaching out and hearing from all kinds of Americans from all walks of life and really representing their views and experiences and opinions right now. It's also more than just a survey. This is an ongoing research. We'll use annual measurements to track the evolution of what goes on in this country.
Nice. Okay. So when and how is this Democracy for All project and the survey taking place?
You can find out more about it if you go to gallup.com/democracy. We're launching it now, and we'll be releasing a report on our findings later in the fall.
Okay. So can listeners take part in the survey and have their voices heard on these issues as well?
We'll be reaching out to Americans across the country to ask for their opinions and experiences and represent their voices. And that work is going to begin in the next few months. And we'll be really focusing on making sure that we have coverage of, you know, people who live in big cities, people who live, you know, nowhere near a city, the young, the old, people whose families have been in the country for generations, and people who are just starting their journeys as Americans. So everyone is part of this research.
Okay. So can people sign up to answer the survey when they go to gallup.com/democracy, or is it more of an informational page at this point?
It's an informational page. Gallup uses survey methods where we reach out to our respondents to make sure that we're getting a representative cross-section of the American public.
Got it. Okay. Awesome. So once again, that website is gallup.com/democracy. Gallup is G-A-L-L-U-P. gallup.com/democracy. You can find out all about the Democracy for All project and the survey that will be taking place, where Gallup will be reaching out to citizens across the nation to take part in this survey and have their voices heard on how they feel about democracy. So gallup.com/democracy. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Ellen Maese. She's the research director of Gallup, and also Brad Rourke, chief external affairs officer of the Kettering Foundation. And both those organizations are partnering for this current Democracy for All project. And it's been great hearing from both of you about this issue and how you're looking for answers that really make a difference in our day-to-day lives. So thank you both so much for being here today and sharing.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Hey you, stop and listen. This is a public service announcement with Dakari Chapman. Why should you know your constitution, and why should you know your rights as a U.S. citizen? How would you like it if someone didn't allow your club to meet at your house? I wouldn't, because that's not cool. How would you like to be tried without a jury? I wouldn't, because that's not cool. These things are not cool. Learn your rights as a U.S. citizen so you know what to do in these situations. Thanks for listening. And remember, it's an American thing, so learn it.
Liberty. It's an American thing. From AmericanThing.org.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Staff Sergeant Cody Mackle, U.S. Army soldier and Master Resilience Trainer. This time of year is often about positive goals and resolutions, but it can also bring feelings of loneliness and isolation. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, nearly half of us experience loneliness, with young adults being the most affected. Luckily, the U.S. Army has some proven strategies to combat loneliness and become more resilient. Staff Sergeant Mackle, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me out here this morning.
So what made you decide to join the Army in the first place?
So I grew up in a small little town in northern Ohio, where at the time, the opioid crisis was through the roof. So I knew personally that if I stayed in that area, things were not going to turn out for me. So my original goal actually was to become a rescue diver in the Coast Guard, but due to some things medically going on at the time, wasn't a good possibility. So my life took an unexpected turn, and here I am about 13 years later, serving in the United States Army.
Where has that journey in the Army taken you?
Oh man, this journey has taken me just about everywhere. I can very proudly say that before I was 21, I had visited all 50 states, and I've been to places like Europe, I've been to Japan, I've been to Korea, I've kind of been a little bit everywhere.
Wow, that's fantastic. Now, what programs does the Army have to impact the well-being and resilience of its soldiers?
So there is a wide variety of programs. So the two that I always like to talk about, number one is the Master Resiliency Program. You know, it helps kind of balance out your internal emotions. It helps you regulate the things that you may not be very good at. There's also another program that holds very dear in my heart. It is the BOSS program. It's the Better Opportunities for Single Soldiers program. It really helps to prevent isolation and build community amongst our single soldiers.
Interesting. Okay. Now, when you talk about master resilience training and how it allows people to kind of control their emotions, most of us don't really think of soldiers as being an emotional bunch of people. So where did that even come from and what kind of impact does it have?
So it kind of came with almost a generational shift. I noticed that when I started, yes, MRT was a thing, but it was kind of more one of those just check the block things. But ever since really, right, I want to say about the 2013, 2014 timeframe, in my personal opinion, there was a real big shift because that's when a lot of the, you know, technology was absolutely booming. So, you know, everything was so focused that emotions really kind of went haywire. So I noticed there was more focus on, hey, how can I teach these soldiers how to feel more included, feel more, you know, adapted to cope with adversity, adapt to change, you know, thrive under these stressful situations. It kind of all just like clicked together right about that point. And I will be the very first to admit, I didn't know how to understand any of it when I first joined. It wasn't until a leader of mine, a mentor of mine still to this day, kind of sat me down and kind of walked me through a lot of how to really cope with life. You know, you mentioned it, that as we think of, you know, the Army, we think of all of these, you know, big, bad, tough soldiers, which, yes, we have a lot of those. But sometimes, you know, you have the folks like me where you go through a dark time. Life is not perfect. But you have to be able to understand when you're not doing all right and step out and say, hey, I'm not doing right now. You know, this is where my headspace is at. You know, you don't know what that headspace may be. And you ask for that help so you can get into those right areas to get the help you need.
Yeah. And what kind of impact does the BOSS program have on soldiers?
So me personally, I've seen a lot of success stories come out of the BOSS program. So when I very first told my story of what happened to me, my phone just became flooded. It would just not only from support, but like people saying, hey, like, how can I help? How can I help? So the BOSS program really just teaches those soldiers. So it's tailored to those 18 to 25 year olds first time away from home. Those are the, I call them kids because, you know, when I grab them, they're literally like my kids. And, you know, you teach them how to cope. I remember, you know, I had one soldier that, you know, we met through the BOSS program. We went on a camping trip. We grew really close. We actually still talk to this day about 12 years later. But she called me one morning at 3:30 in the morning and she's like, hey, you know, Sarmac, I'm in this situation. I don't like where I'm at and I don't know what to do. I literally grabbed my car keys, I grabbed my wallet, I ran out the door, drove 3.5 hours, grabbed her. You know, we stopped for brunch on the way back, you know, kind of talked through what she was going through. You know, it kind of creates all of those things that really just give them a sense of purpose. It gives them a sense of belonging.
Okay. Why do you think younger generations are experiencing increased levels of loneliness and isolation?
I think part of it is the technology shift. You know, don't take this as me bashing technology. I love technology. It's what I go to school for. It's, you know, it's kind of like the backbone of my life. But it's taking away, you know, the deeper connections, the face-to-face human connections. If you take, you know, someone, you know, my generation versus one of these newer generations, sit them both down at a table, you're going to notice that the older generation is going to know how to have a human conversation versus the, you know, the younger generations are losing that tangible skill of sitting here at a table, having a conversation because they only know how to do it via their thumbs.
Yeah, good point. So what are some techniques that anyone can implement to encourage belonging or even manage our emotions better?
So me personally is, you know, this year I'm trying to focus on prioritizing authentic human connections. Last year, I realized I spent a lot of time online, whether it was gaming with my friends, on the phone, on the TikToks. So this year, I'm trying to take a point to set all that down. I'm trying to, you know, if I know I'm going to have this 4-hour texting conversation with a friend, instead, I'm going to call them and say, you know, hey, there's a flea market going on here this weekend. Would you rather go walk and talk about whatever it may be? You know, hey, would you like to go meet for coffee? Get off the phones for a little bit, you know, join a social club, you know, go to your BOSS program, go visit some community events. Don't always just, you know, log online and be like, all right, who can I chat with today?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you mentioned the outpouring of support after what happened to you, which was wanting to give up, a suicide attempt. How did that support affect your outlook and your experience?
So I will be the very first to admit that when what happened to me kind of happened, I did not know how to handle it. I used the BOSS program as kind of like my outlet. I let everything go and I just hid. It's what we as men do. We don't tell our feelings. Like, being vulnerable is something that most of us are not very good at as a man. It wasn't until somebody sat me down and said, "Hey, there's something inside of you. I can kind of see it, but I can't quite pull it out. Like, what's going on?" And I have no idea how they did it, but it was like the floodgates opened. And ever since then, like, people see my story and it's almost inspiring, the amount of people that say, "Hey, I'm also going through this." Like, then they'll come to me and be like, "Hey, I'm experiencing XYZ. You know, did you experience any of these? How did you cope through these type of deals?" And I always start with, number one, it's okay to be not okay sometimes. And that's sometimes a hard concept to comprehend. Number two is, they have to be surrounded by people. You cannot do things in life alone. You have to surround yourself with people.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so where can listeners go to learn more about these impactful programs and life in the Army in general?
So there is countless opportunities to build some lifelong friendships, but if you want to continue your journey or learn more about the Army, you can visit goarmy.com or visit a local recruiter in your area.
Awesome. Okay, so once again, that website is goarmy.com, short and simple, goarmy.com. You can find out more about life in the Army, as well as the impactful programs we've been talking about today, Master Resilience Training and the BOSS program, among many, many others. And we've been speaking today with Staff Sergeant Cody Mackle. He's a U.S. Army soldier and Master Resilience Trainer. And Staff Sergeant Mackle, I really appreciate you being here, sharing your story, sharing the impact that these programs have had on you and what other people can do to foster that connection among fellow human beings as well. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me out this morning.
Serving my country changed my life forever. And when I got home, every day was a struggle. I felt trapped. But everything changed the day my family received a specially adapted custom home from Homes for Our Troops. Now we have a safe and accessible home to enjoy the freedom I fought for.
Homes for Our Troops builds and donates specially adapted custom homes nationwide for severely injured post-9/11 veterans. Join our mission at hfotusa.org.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Dr. Clayne K. White, Chair of Pediatric Orthopedics at the Children's Hospital, Colorado. 50,000 people in the U.S. live with the genetic condition of dwarfism, which comes with many health-related and social challenges. Dr. White, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, what exactly is dwarfism?
Well, specifically, we're speaking about one type of dwarfism, achondroplasia, which is the most common form of short limb dwarfism. And this results from a change in one of the genes that mediates the growth in our skeleton. And so for achondroplasia specifically, the average height of an adult male is about 4 feet, 4 inches tall, and for women is about 4 foot, 1 inch.
And what sets achondroplasia apart from other types of dwarfism?
Well, achondroplasia is the most common form of dwarfism, has been studied probably the most of any form of dwarfism. And as such, there are now some emerging treatments and actually even one treatment available, which is FDA approved in terms of improving growth velocity so that individuals with achondroplasia could potentially, if they choose, become taller.
Interesting. Okay. What kind of treatment would that be? Is it a medication?
Yeah, it's a medication. The treatment at present is an injectable medication, which is given daily and results in growth of acceleration of about a centimeter and a half per year compared to those who are not treated, which I relate to, in American non-metric numbers to about 6/10 inch per year. So when I counsel families about whether they're interested in this treatment, if you take the drug for 10 years, then your growth will improve by about 6 inches compared to what you would gain if you were not treated.
Wow. Okay. Now, generally speaking, how does achondroplasia impact a person's life beyond their height?
Yeah. So most people with achondroplasia live happy and productive lives, to be clear. But there are many tasks that they rely on, adaptive equipment, for activities such as driving, shopping, and other forms of self-care. They do have some unique health considerations, As infants, they can develop life-threatening spinal cord compression, which increases their risk for sudden infant death syndrome, which has been estimated to be as high as 7% in babies with achondroplasia. As they grow up, they can have some other health issues, such as more frequent ear infections, some bone and joint problems. And as adults, they can have compression of their nerves and their spinal canal because of spinal canal narrowing. And if left untreated, that can result in nerve compression and long-term weakness and disability.
What are some of the most common misconceptions about living with achondroplasia?
Yeah, I think, you know, the reality is that while individuals, particularly adults with achondroplasia, are shorter than average, they tend to do quite well in the world. They live their daily lives much like you and I do. But this leads to the misconception, because they are, you know, less than average statured, that this is a significant disability. And for the most part, it's not. But again, there are some associated health issues with achondroplasia that need to be addressed.
Yeah. What causes achondroplasia?
So this is a genetic condition. There's a change in one of the genes that's responsible for growth, primarily in our limbs and in certain aspects, our spine. And when this gene is changed, usually spontaneously, then that gene change results in a dysregulation of growth. And so that then consequentially results in short stature.
So if it's a genetic condition, is it more likely that if a parent has it, that the child will have it, or can it just come out of seemingly nowhere?
Yeah, so a little bit of both, actually. So, you know, this is what we call an autosomal dominant disorder, which means that if a parent has this, if I'm an individual with achondroplasia and I want to have a child, there's a 50% chance that my child will have achondroplasia. And so that's why it's very important to engage with a genetic counselor prior to embarking on having a family, so that you understand what the statistics are here. To be fair, though, about 80% of individuals with achondroplasia, again, are spontaneous changes in the gene. And so there will be no family history. The parents aren't even carriers of this gene change. And so it seemingly then comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, okay. Now, you mentioned the FDA-approved treatment. What should a parent or caregiver do if they have a child diagnosed with achondroplasia and they're interested in pursuing new treatment options?
Yeah, well, I think first and foremost, it's important to reassure families that while their child will potentially not grow as tall as their age-matched peers, they can and will have a happy and active childhood. But I really encourage people to meet with an experienced healthcare team to talk about the potential options, not only for these treatments, but also for other surveillance and healthcare needs to maximize their child's potential.
Okay. And where can people go for more information?
Well, first and foremost, I would always check with your own local healthcare provider. Here at Children's Hospital Colorado, we have a robust website of educational materials that families can access. Alternatively, you can visit Little People of America at LP Online or visit risinglove.com, which is a resource provided by BioMarin.
Okay, awesome. So once again, lpaonline.org, that's Little People of America, lpaonline.org. You can go there for more information on achondroplasia. You can also go to risinglove.com, risinglove.com. And of course, talk with your care provider if you have a child who's diagnosed with achondroplasia and you'd like to explore different treatment options that are new. We've been speaking today with Dr. Clayne K. White. He's the chair of pediatric orthopedics at the Children's Hospital Colorado. And Dr. White, I really appreciate you being here and letting us know more about this new treatment options and the reality of what it is like living with achondroplasia, the most common type of dwarfism. So really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, January 27th at 8 p.m. benefiting the Friendship Circle, and Monday, February 10th at 8 p.m. benefiting the First Friday Foundation. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. The Shade Tree is holding its Hope for the New Year fundraising campaign through the end of January, so you have a few more days to help make a difference in the lives of domestic violence survivors. Donations will support the shelter's comprehensive programming and operations while expanding its outreach. Any amount helps, and you can donate at theshadetree.org. That's theshadetree.org. And the Nevada chapter of the National Bleeding Disorders Foundation is holding their 10th annual Winter Wine Fest on Friday, February 7th from 7 to 9 p.m. with the VIP experience at 6 p.m. at the Vegas Events Center downtown, 1201 Las Vegas Boulevard, just south of Charleston. Grab a glass of red while supporting those with bleeding disorders. Get your tickets at nv.bleeding.org. That's NV for Nevada. nv.bleeding.org.